You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Got bruises, and they're not all on the outside either, sports fans. I want to talk about community-based mental health. So I'm talking to Josh Goldberg, I don't know, a month or two ago, and he says, hey, I got something you need to watch. I said, okay. So you can find this video if you care to watch the video. You'll hear the audio here today, but if you care to see the video itself, you can go to the All Marine Radio website, okay? If you click on Post Traumatic Winning and you go to the resource page, you'll find the link to this, all right? It is entitled A Conversation with Dr. Madhar. I can't say his name. It's an Indian name. Madhukar, Madhukar Trivedi, and Dr. Vikram Patel. New ideas for strengthening community mental health care from North Texas to India. Now, what they study is depression. Okay? So we've been talking about suicide today and causes of death and things like that. So why all the causes of death are... Why all the major causes of death in this country are going south, and suicide increased since 1990 by 33%. Okay. And the major heart disease and stroke are down almost 40%. Okay. So pretty astounding when you look at those numbers, right? So what is going on in the world of mental health that we now see suicide as something that, yeah, you know, what the hell? Certainly doesn't have, right, the same taboo that it did when we were kids. I mean, I was a Catholic. I mean, you're going to go straight to hell. You're not even going to be able to negotiate your fate. Yeah, how about that? That'll about suck. So, yeah, so I can't do that. I'm out. If you're a Catholic, that was it. So anyway, all right. So here's the discussion, and I'll chime in. It's interesting. The moderator, the woman who you're going to hear speak first and introduce the two PhDs, I shouldn't say PhDs. I'm not exactly sure if they are a PhD or, in fact, maybe one of them might be a medical doctor. I think the guy whose name that I can't pronounce might be a medical doctor. And I think Dr. Patel is a PhD. But don't quote me on that. Anywho, she, the woman you're going to hear speak first, she suffers from depression. So, here you have it.
First of all, thank all of you for taking your time today to come listen to this. We have a number of esteemed leaders in our community that really make a difference on a daily basis, and I'm so excited for you to hear this information. We've heard the credentials of these amazing men, but I am a storyteller, and I thought that it might be best to really convey to you how lucky you are to be here today by telling you a story. So the story is this. In May of 1850, there was a man that got up in front of a medical group in Vienna. His name was Ignaz Semmelweis, and he had a very important discovery. He wanted to tell people, you need to wash your hands before examining patients. And he developed this information in a very interesting way. He had looked at the difference between what happened with deaths of mothers with midwives versus doctors or professionals in the field, and he noticed that there was about 1 in 1,000 deaths with midwives, and that the deaths were 20, sometimes up to 20 times higher when they were working with the doctors. Now, some of the doctors took great offense with this because at the time the tradition was, as you went to see patients, you sort of had the badge of honor on your white uniform by having the blood from all the various patients that you dealt with during the day and going to the next patients. So even though Ignaz Semmelweis very carefully documented this within his own wards, that he dealt with, he was able to completely eliminate the deaths of mothers by transference of disease. He wasn't really listened to until much later. And much later being Pasteur came around in about 1860. He created a real visual indication and some real effects of the understanding of bacteria. But in 1881, does anybody know what happened in 1881? Okay. In July of 1881, President Garfield was shot. And when he was shot, the physicians on the scene took with their bare hands trying to find the bullet. They searched all over his back, and he died 2 months later of sepsis because they had created an infection in his back nowhere near where the bullet was. And, in fact, if they had left the bullet alone, he probably would have lived. Now, I would propose to you that the work that these men that are doing today is the equivalent of what Ignaz Semmelweis found in 1850, that some of the very keys to unlock and treat mental illness in our communities today are actually going back to the community level, and with the help of great institutions like UT Southwestern, really bringing care back to a very elementary level. So I know that's kind of a heady introduction, but I really, as all of you in the community who know me well, I've researched this field intensely, and what these men are doing is groundbreaking. I was trying to explain to my husband, these guys are like the Steve Jobs and the, you know, Warren Buffett. I mean, this is really the groundbreaking work that they are doing. So I'm so glad you're going to be here today to hear it. Okay, so with that cheerleading, I will start with Dr. Patel. So Dr. Patel has done intensive research all over the world with mental health and communities. So Dr. Patel, can you tell us a little bit about what do you think we in the global north can learn from what you have learned from these deep investigations in the global south?
Thank you. Thank you. First of all, can I say that was the most amazing introduction I've ever received. And you know, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I don't think I have anywhere near the wealth that Steve Jobs or Warren Buffett has. I wish I did. I could be having my own foundation.
No, but we're talking in terms of impact.
I wish that people with that kind of wealth and influence actually were more devoted towards supporting mental health. And I think it's certainly a struggle for me is to get the rich people of this world to begin to see mental health as a worthy cause to give to. It hasn't happened to the scale that we see for HIV or maternal and child health in the global context, but I certainly hope that that's...
Is that not working? Here.
I certainly hope that we will see a lot more philanthropic giving to the cause of mental health in the global south, as it were. So your question was really about what can the global north learn from the developing world. First of all, I have to say, as far as mental health is concerned,
I have to say that this, if you listen to this, it's fascinating. The evidence that they have discovered, in their research that they've done. So again, this was done at University of Texas Southwest in the state of Texas.
I don't think any country can be considered to be developed. I think every country is developing, and certainly everything I've read about the U.S. in terms of its mental health care system strikes me as being not that dissimilar in some respects in terms of lack of access to care, but also more fundamental issues to do with people with mental health problems living on the streets and in prisons. So I think there's a lot that both sides of the world can learn from each other. And for me, the most important opportunity that has come from the developing world is the very large acceptance of frontline workers. That is to say, community-based workers who are employed by or incentivized by the formal healthcare system, who provide interventions for a whole range of health problems, not just mental health. All that I've done is taken an established approach for a variety of other health problems and applied it to mental health. These are ordinary people with specific task-based training who then operate as outreach workers of the healthcare system and provide support to people with health problems in their own homes and in their own communities. And I think that this might be an approach that might have some value in even a highly resourced specialized setting such as the U.S. And I'll just finish by saying that, incredibly, this approach already is existing here in some parts of the country, as, for example, in the state of Washington. And just last week, I got a message from the chief of Thrive New York City, which is a billion-dollar investment by the mayor to improve mental health care in the city of New York, saying he was really excited that the word star shifting, which is something we use in global health for poor countries, had actually been used by the mayor as his vision for mental health care in New York City. So maybe that kind of reverse engineering is already happening.
And one of the things that might be helpful is to talk a little bit about what you've done, because I don't know how many people have had a chance to see your TED Talk, but maybe you can talk a little bit about how I think it was very interesting in Ground Rounds. Just previously you were talking about how you solicited these special people within your community, which, you know, I was thinking, oh, there must have been a special screening process. You maybe looked for all these indicators of who it should be, and then you had a much more simple solution that was very direct. And so why don't you talk about that?
Well, I started off thinking that you needed a special kind of person to deliver mental health care, and therefore we had a very special procedure right at the start of when we began this kind of work about 10 or 15 years ago. So this involved, for example, getting people to do role plays in front of a panel of three mental health professionals who would then rate you on a variety of things like, did the person show empathy, and did the person, you know, did he have listening skills, and so on and so forth, which is a traditional way in which you assess psychotherapeutic skills. We kind of realized very quickly that this was very laborious and also not very accurate. And so instead we just abandoned any kind of screening and simply put an ad in the papers and said, are you interested in working with people with mental health problems in the community? And if you showed up to the door, then presumably you had some kind of interest, at least, some kind of calling. And that, to us, was sufficient as an entry criterion. Then you entered into a period of brief training, followed by supervised work, that ultimately led you to graduate into a qualified community-based mental health worker.
And Dr. Trivedi, can you talk a little bit, I'm not sure everybody in the community is familiar with the two major projects that you're working with, Vital Sign 6, where you're working with 19 primary care clinics in Dallas, and also the Risk and Resilience Network in Teens. One of the reasons why I really was so excited about having both these men on stage together today is they are really doing very similar work in a lot of ways. And Dr. Trivedi is doing this through the primary care environment and through high schools. Dr. Patel is actually even going deeper into the community, I think, by having outreach community members spread out throughout the community. But I think ultimately this is the same, we're attacking the same issues and providing sort of a tiered base level of care so that it's easy to access, it's non-intimidating, and people can get the help they need. So Dr. Trivedi, why don't you talk a little bit about the two main projects you're working with?
Thank you. And thank you for all of you coming in. I think, as Dr. Patel said, and Julie's heard me say this many, many times, I think we will continue to do research and write those papers and more of them as long as they keep me here. But the biggest impact to change this equation in our field is going to come from you. The community has to want it and has to be engaged. So I am so pleased all of you are here. We can't do this without really the community involved. So what Julie is saying is, what we are interested in the following. It's now 35 years since, or 40 years since antidepressants started really becoming routinely used, and antidepressant psychotherapies are being available that are very well documented to be effective, and ECT and transmagnetic stimulation, a number of treatments available in the world and in the United States, and yet, outcomes for our patients as a general population have not improved. And so what is the problem? So first thing we wanted to address was really 85% of people with depression in the United States never see a mental health professional in their entire lives. They really are being taken care of in various ways in primary care settings. They are pediatricians when they are young, they are primary care physicians, they are obstetricians if they are women, and they never get into mental health care. So we wanted to really start there. So that's why the network was started in primary care, and we have basically introduced something that is called measurement-based care. So if you want to diagnose and treat depression, you have to measure. And unfortunately, my field has done a disservice. We have not really enforced the idea that you have to measure what you're doing, otherwise you don't know where you're going. So we have developed a software called Vital Sign 6. These primary care practices over the last just 1 year have now screened 40,000 patients, and we have created a very elegant triage system that allows us to really answer the question of right patient, right treatment at the right place. So that those patients who are really started in treatment in primary care, they actually get diagnosed, they get measured, and their treatment happens in primary care. When that is not sufficient and they need a mental health specialist, then we provide the arrangement to refer them to the right place. And that system has actually been phenomenally effective, and some of our partners are here in the audience. So that's the first part, is to really improve the access to care and improve outcomes for patients with the treatments we currently have available. But we know that that's not going to be sufficient. There are really research questions that need to be asked to address, to understand developing new treatments, and that is the second part of what we are doing here at UT Southwestern in terms of developing new treatments. And based on both of these things, we are actually launched a large project like the Framingham study for depression, where we are identifying 2,500 people with depression and really going to start develop blood and brain tests. Because one of the major problems in our field is because there is not a lab test, people feel like maybe that's not real. And so we are really very seriously focused on developing research ideas in order to do that. And that's and it's already started paying off. We just published a paper where a protein called C-reactive protein, if we measure that, then we can actually improve the outcomes of patients if you match that protein assessment with the right treatment by 30%. So therefore, we are really beginning to do that already, and that's the second part of this. And that is all designed to try to improve the quality of care, improve outcomes, and then develop these tests so that in 5 years, people will not be wondering, what treatment should I get? They'll get a blood test or a brain test, and we can begin to match patients with treatments. It will not lead to treatment matching for 100% of patients, but I think we will be profoundly farther along than we have been for the last 30 years. And then the final, which is the Risk and Resilience Network, and our work in high schools and middle schools, is the following. Most of advances in medicine, cancers, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, etc., have really ultimately come from prevention and early recognition and not wait. What we currently do for depression is really wait until somebody has stage 4 breast cancer and then start treatment. The time between when the patient has the first symptoms and the first treatment is 10 to 12 years. We would not tolerate this in any field of medicine, diabetes, hypertension, colon cancer, anything. in depression, the community and us all accept it, and we have to change it. So that's sort of the focus of our work, is we have to change this, and the only way to change it is to be in the community and not wait for patients to come to the ivory tower. Therefore, our interest in going to community primary care practices. These practices actually that we are in, some of them are, like I said, are here. They were not actually officially affiliated with UT Southwestern. They were independent primary care practices, and that is really how we have started. We are expanding it. Some of my partners from other parts are here. We'll go to pediatric clinics eventually, and I think that is sort of the goal of this.
Hold on to the microphone. Can everybody hear me if I speak loudly enough? So hold on, because I'm going to do a little follow-on to this. So you're not escaping the microphone. So one of the things that...
All right, now pay attention to this.
...that I found really interesting in this 40,000 people that you have surveyed, you found fairly consistently about 15% having depression, correct? And so talk a little bit about the triage that you're finding of how much you can actually care for in the, well, two things. I don't think people maybe realize from what you just said, when do you measure? Like, do you just wait for people to say, oh, I'm depressed? Or how do you measure? And two, how much of that percent, 15% actually end up having to go to a psychiatrist?
So one thing, like, at the end of this exercise today, and maybe in the next 2-3 years, I want all of you to be actually as informed as Julie is about all this. She is absolutely right. So our screening is really universal screening. If you, what traditionally happens in primary care is people wait, and the patient either complains or starts crying or is suicidal is when they screen. That is not called screening, because then it's too late. So what this is, we are primary care practices are universally screening. Every patient coming into the clinic gets screened for depression, and that is how you identify whether they need to have further monitoring or not. And that is the 12 to 15% of patients. Once they get screened positive, then they get routine measurement at every treatment occasion to monitor their outcomes. And if the patients have significant need for psychiatry, they are referred, and that has been really less than 1% of the population. Because there is, like hypertension, nobody actually, or headache, imagine if for headache everybody wanted to go to see a neurosurgeon, you couldn't find any. That is what we do with depression. Instead, what we are doing, changing the paradigm so that most patients who can be treated in primary care get treated there, and then those who need to go to psychiatry or psychotherapy, then they go there. And we've also created teletherapy modules and other things to envelop all this. But as a result, we are actually leaving patients in the right place and getting the right treatment without having to run around to find a psychiatrist.
Now, again, I think that's fascinating, right? So 40,000 people in this study, 15% had three tests that would indicate they're prone to have the symptoms of depression. So that begins the monitoring, okay, which is what? So 10% of 40,000 is 4,000, and another half of that is 2, so that's 15% is equals 6,000 of the 40,000 have symptoms. Okay, once you get three positive indications of the symptoms, then you then get screened every time you come for a visit. Okay. Of the 6,000 people, less than 1% ultimately needed psychiatric care. Okay, I'll say that again. Of the 6,000, less than 1% ultimately needed psychiatric care, everybody else being treated by their general practitioner. Very, very interesting stuff.
And Dr. Patel, do you find, is that similar to what you were finding in your work, that the majority, if you use the old 80-20 rule, were you finding that most of the people could be cared for, even did they require medication, or what were the kind of results you were seeing in your global environment?
Well, I completely agree with Madhukar. I think essentially the idea of a one-size-fits-all model.
Did you hear the way he said Madhukar? He said it so easy. It made me, I want to slap him.
is the fundamental error in mental health care. I think it's borrowed from the model of infectious diseases.
Right. So maybe I used a bad analogy.
No, it's not a bad analogy, but I think it's the inspiration to medicine came from infectious diseases. Let's be honest. This was the kind of conditions that killed most of us 100 years ago. And we have taken that, as it were, dichotomous approach. Either you have an infection or you don't. And if you have an infection, no matter where you live, who you live with, what your gender is, you would give the same course of treatment. We've taken that very simplistic reductionist approach to infectious diseases and assumed that all chronic conditions, which are the conditions that will kill most of us in this age of our lives, that we think that one-size-fits-all approach applies, and it doesn't. And I think what Madhuka describes is exactly right, that if you say that 15% of the population has depression, it doesn't mean that all 15% actually need the same intervention. It's quite likely that of that 15%, maybe three-quarters or maybe two-thirds could be treated very well through a community or primary care-based approach. And I would extend that to the community, not just primary care, through self-care. Mm-hmm. I think there's a revolution happening out there in terms of peer support and self-care interventions, including through the digital space. A proportion of those individuals might need some kind of care in the primary care facility, which could include antidepressants, but often may just be psychological mm-hmm. treatments. And about a third of people of that 15% might actually need to graduate based on their response or severity to see a specialist. That's the kind of mixed, or what some people call balanced model of care that we should be aspiring to.
Right. I think really this idea of personalized medicine, I can say for myself, having been a consumer of the mental health system, in fact, Dr. Trevetti has very patiently counseled me because I recently relapsed in September of last year, and I was put on a new medication, and I came to him and said, well, I just gave a talk at Miami, and they basically said this medication I've been taking for the past 15 years didn't do any good at all. Why am I even taking this medication? Maybe I should just do ECT, and that's it, because in Miami they said it was my sleep, exercise, nutrition, meditation. This was all the things making me well, not the medication. And Dr. Trevetti very wisely said, well, I wasn't in the room where God and the physician in Miami made the decision about your health care, which I thought was very enlightening for me. And I think one thing for those of you that are working in the community that's very frustrating, but also important for us to understand, that people in the medical profession are trying to do the best, absolute best that they can with the tools that they have today. And there's two things that are incumbent on us because of that. One, we have to be very open and honest about communicating what is happening with either the people we're trying to help or ourselves. And two, be patient with them. I recently had ECT in September and was actually on the gurney talking with my physician about, well, what do you think? Do I need another ECT treatment beyond this, or do I not? Although that sounds very bizarre, right now the tools we have today are feedback from the patient if something is working, and the measurement tools. So I think it's really important for honest and open communication and equal participation and responsibility on the patient side to really make some of these therapies work.
So one related issue that I talk about quite a bit, and I encourage you all to...
Let me just define something. So ECT is electroconvulsive therapy. Sounds pretty intimidating. Is a procedure done under general anesthesia in which small electric currents are passed through the brain, intentionally triggering a brief seizure. ECT seems to cause changes in brain chemistry, which can quickly reverse symptoms of certain mental health conditions. So that's what she was talking about that she had.
Think about it. It's really, you should, anybody who has depression or is even having any concerns should be very well-informed consumers. I think that if you don't help participate in that process, then your providers are not going to be able to do a good job. I don't want you to raise your hands, but if I did ask you all, everybody who's 30 or 40 and above, do you know what your cholesterol level is or your blood pressure is? Most of you would raise your hands. But if I ask you, have you ever had screening for depression in your primary, in your medical visits, most of you will say no. In spite of the fact that most guidelines suggested that that is necessary, in spite of the fact that we know that depression is as common, if not more common, than diabetes or hypertension, we don't actually make it a part of our information and vocabulary. So we have to get that done. Otherwise, we are not really advancing. And even if we do all this, I think, which is why this sort of what Julie talked about, our large project in terms of doing the research, is going to be still needed. Because
right.
Because I think that we now know this is related to brain function. We know this is a brain disorder. We have not had a chance to do the hard work. Remember, 50 years back, we didn't know about heart disease, what we do now. We have not done that work in depression, and at least, thankfully, with people like Julie and others' help, we have started with Caruth Foundation, et cetera, started that process so that we will actually develop biomarkers, that is blood tests and brain tests, that will help us at least match patients with treatments and even begin to identify risk in advance so that we can then intervene. And that work has to be done if we are going to change the paradigm for depression and bipolar disorder. Otherwise, I think there is still remains this concern that maybe this is not real. And I can tell you two things about that. One is, if you give me 15 minutes or 30 minutes with a patient who has depression, I can tell you how real it is. It is not in somebody's head, it is real. And the second biggest thing is, if you get the right treatment, the difference between when you have symptoms and when you are well is night and day. It is actually much better than if you have diabetes or seizure disorder or migraine. This improvement that you see if you get the right treatment is remarkable, and it's amazing. And Julie is a good example. The difference is just amazing. So
it's very interesting, you know, as they talk about screening and prevention in all of this, right? Screening and prevention. And again, if I take this and move it towards living with trauma, right? You know, again, it comes back to this ad nauseum, but it is talking about it, admitting that it's there, and beginning the discussion about it, so that you can get the help that you need. But the first thing is, in the whole process of triaging somebody, is what? Gotta talk about it. And it's a thing. It's a single thing that we have the biggest problem doing as people. So anyway, that's why this to me is so fascinating, because if you listen to what they conceptually talk about, I mean, it's pretty, you know, when do we deal with trauma? When somebody blows up with it, right? As opposed to having a consistent message of, we're going to talk about it. We wait till somebody blows up, then we deal with it. Yeah, so the parallels between this and living with trauma are, in my opinion, 100%.
That makes it tells me that it is real. We have seen enough of it. So,
and I would just add, I think one of the challenges we have as somebody who manages depression / bipolar disease, one of the challenges is, even as individuals, we are, I was describing what I do to sort of monitor myself, and my friend said, oh my gosh, it's like you're driving a car without a gas gauge. And I said, that is exactly right. Because one of the things that's very difficult about these diseases is that they do affect your thinking. And so even as recently as last September, I was saying to my daughter, even though I have had ECT before, I knew that it recovered, I've given speeches about it, I've talked openly about it, I was saying to my daughter last September, if something happens to me, it's not out of lack of love for you. And my daughter said back to me, Mom, now this is somebody that I've been saying since she was 5 years old, this is a disease, this is something that can be managed and addressed. She said back to me, Mom, we're going to get you back to Dallas, we're going to get you in treatment, and you're going to be fine. And so what's difficult, I think, compared to other diseases, is this hard thing that the very people you're treating their own brains are sort of turning against them a little bit, and it's really incumbent upon allowing these people to maintain their own integrity, but helping them obtain the right help. And it's a delicate balance, I think, to find that.
Absolutely. A 45-year-old male has some chest discomfort. The brain tells you, now do something, go to the ER, because you may be having a heart attack. When you have your depressive symptoms beginning to return, the organ that is really having the symptoms is the brain, and it may not be able to tell you, and you have to figure out, and with your physicians and your therapists or providers
and
your community, to have a system. And that is the other work that I think can and should be incorporated in this kind of holistic approach.
I'm going to do one more small thing. Dr. Patel wrote a great manual, which I purchased off Amazon, I read. But I would also say that Dr. Patel is going to update this with 15 years worth of updates, right? Is that about right? And we'll be publishing it online in the summertime. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And then we'll go to general Q&A.
So first of all, I want to say that, Madhuka, what you said, I want to just follow up on that. I think it is true that the real challenge for people with depression is that you can't see it. It's not just that your brain can't see it, because it's in fact the part of the body which is affected, but also anyone around you often can't see it. And when they can see it, when you can express those symptoms, people's first reaction is that this is just part of the suffering of your life. And the next reaction is, come on, you know, tighten your belt. I mean, really, it's not so bad. You can deal with this, surely, etc. So it's almost like you feel embarrassed that you need to seek help, because somehow it suggests you're weak or there's something deficient in you. And I think it's all of these terrible sorts of assumptions that I think people with depression have to struggle with, and therefore I think that also explains why they don't disclose this very easily. The other thing I will tell you is that people who are poor and socially disadvantaged have a double jeopardy. They, of course, as we now know, bear a disproportionate burden of depression, contrary to what you would often see. If you believe the celebrity disclosures, you think that depression was a problem of the wealthy and successful. But actually, if you look at epidemiology, that is research that's done in the population, you see exactly the opposite picture. Depression is much commoner amongst those who are disadvantaged. But for them, there's a double jeopardy. Not only do they face a higher risk of depression, but also a higher challenge of disclosing it, because there's even a further risk that people say, well, this is your miserable life.
Right.
And therefore, somehow, it's only people who are wealthy and well-off who have, as it were, the entitlement to be depressed. But turning to the question about the book, so later this summer, the Royal College in Britain will publish the second edition of this book. It is... You're right, a much more updated version. When I wrote this book, it was published in 2003. I wrote it, therefore, about in 2001, more than 15 years ago. At that stage, there was not a single shred of evidence that anything that I was writing about actually was true. I have to say, it was an ideology. The idea that one could translate mental health care into the hands of ordinary people in the community was an ideology. In the last 15 years, that there is now a very solid science that supports that ideology. So what we now have in the book that will come out later this year is actually a much enriched and expanded version that incorporates some of the procedures that have been used in building that base of science. And what I'm really thrilled about is that it'll be free. So the Royal College has managed to secure some limited funding from a couple of foundations that will mean that the digital version of the book will be completely free. And that is really what we had hoped for right from the beginning.
Just one point, Julie, and that is we have been talking about this idea of being in the community and, in fact, even using community counselors to address these issues with depression, to create a staged or a triage process. I don't want to leave this discussion without really mentioning the other part, and that is there is a group of patients for whom the current treatments we have are not good. They don't succeed in achieving. So there is treatment-resistant forms of depression, bipolar disorder. which require specialty care, specialized care. And I think we have to be thinking about delivering that better and more. And again, that is something that we are building at UT Southwestern, but others are too. And that is a reality also. So I don't want to leave this discussion by saying everything is in this landscape where everything can be done in the community. There is still a very significant need and significant need for research of magnetic stimulation and other forms of circuit modulations in the brain are beginning to be well studied. That needs more work needs to be done because that is what is going to help us with these groups of people for whom current treatments are not really effective.
Yes, and actually, I got so excited with my Ignaz Semmelweis story, I forgot to quote some of the stats that I think.
Let me I have this to say about that. You know, somebody, I can't remember, teaching tactics. They were, when you teach decision making, for instance, you know, people always want to, you know, they want to talk about recognition prime decision making and things like that. And if you show them like a recognition primed decision making like model, and then you show them an analytical model, you know, you get this great attention for the recognition stuff. And then when you see the analytical with all of its steps, you hear this, And I always make the point, and I'll make the same point here, that it's the misapplication of technique that screws things up, okay? So when I put up the schematic of analytical decision-making and the staff planning process that was used in World War II, there's like 700 steps to it, okay? And people look at it and they're like, wait a minute. Do you see all that newsreel footage? You see all that stuff coming together on a beach? You see all that? This is what did that. So don't groan, man. That's how you get through that gate. Is this. So in terms of editorializing one treatment or another, you know, I think there is great danger in that. What you're trying to do through, whether you're talking about decision making or you're talking about mental health, living with trauma, living with depression, is you're trying to make sure that the appropriate actions get taken in the appropriate situations. And the thing that is tremendously frustrating, right, and I think a lot of veterans who've gone to the VA have felt this, like, yeah, I got the broad, you know, I got the same thing everybody else did. Okay, and so what, you know, whether you're triaging somebody and sitting down and talking to them and finding out if they have, substantial mental health issues that you need to then turn to on, or if they in fact are living with the same kind of trauma and stuff that others, and seem to be able to, are open to discussing it, and don't show any indicators of anything more substantive than that, right, so that you believe that you can, you know, through discussion, you can continue to triage, continue to monitor, and help them. And so I think it's the misapplication of a single technique to too broad of an audience, to an audience that it doesn't apply to, that gets any technique off the rails. Okay, any technique. And again, when you have a system where you say mental health and everybody says, okay, that's not me, that's them, what you're doing is everything they talked about here is even in depression, the role of the general practitioner, right? The role of exercise, food, diet, right? Food and diet are the same thing, and sleep. And the general practitioner's monitoring of that, right? And that is huge in this, okay, is huge in that. And so, and again, but that doesn't discount the fact that there is a segment of the population that is going to have more substantive needs and are going to need to see mental health professionals. And so, by all means, you know, there is no, and I say this when I talk about decision making, there is no editorial comment associated with either recognition prime decision making or analytical decision making. they're either appropriate or inappropriate based on the situation and the amount of time available. If you're attempting to do analytical decision-making when you don't have the time, guess what? The decision is going to be late. It's not going to be well disseminated. It's not going to be well understood. It's not going to be rehearsed. And guess what's going to happen? You're going to have shit performance. So the thing that makes decision-making techniques go is time. Can I execute this in time knowing I have to get it out there? And so I would offer you the same parallel with this, right? There is no better or worse technique. It is if it's appropriate. And if we're painting with too broad a brush, then we have to fix that. We have to fix that. All right, there's a few more minutes of this. We'll take a break. Gunnar's going to join us.
Really talk about how severe this problem is. These are diseases that impact 450 million people globally. There's reduced lifespan in many countries from 10 to 20 years. In the U.S., about 10 to 12 years. Being the nerdy person I am, I actually went to the CDC for the latest stats from the CDC. The number of suicides has now surpassed, in the U.S. annually, has now surpassed the number of deaths by breast cancer. So this is an enormous problem, but I don't want to go away from this, everybody feeling depressed. I think that there is enormous upside because with, you know, actually very inexpensive intervention at the community level, I think we can make huge, not to quote our lovely leader, but we can make incredible, I can't even use this word anymore, it's terrible, incredible change in our community, in our world, by just allowing the information to seep out to a very elementary level. And that's what I'm so excited about, but both Bjork and I feel very honored to be here today. So with that, why don't we open it up for Q&A? Does anybody have any questions? No questions? Because I can ask about 21. Okay, great.
We'll listen to one question, then we'll take a break. And
you have to be way in the back of the room.
Mike Musselman's going to join us.
Julie, first, thanks for all you're doing in this field. And I wanted to ask this panel, with respect to other areas of mental health, schizophrenia, bipolar, et cetera, we all know the healthcare system works the same way, meaning we wait until there's an emergency and you're in stage four to deal with it. What do you see in the research field that would help us in the early detection and treatment in early phases of other major serious medical mental health problems?
So Carol actually can speak more about schizophrenia also, but I think that there again, screening and recognition early on, especially at least bipolar disorder, similar screening approaches actually should work. And we should start this in teenage years and not wait until they are 30 and 40 for bipolar disorder. Easily should be done. And same thing for schizophrenia. There is, Carol should say, but early recognition and early psychosis interventions have the promise of getting significantly better outcomes than waiting the 5 and 7 years before they start treatment.
Oh, I could just add, in the area of schizophrenia, in fact, in all of our mental health disorders, psychiatrists like to wait until the disorder is fully developed and manifests itself so that we can characterize it and rate it. And that would be like waiting till stage four breast cancer like the other people have suggested. And the whole within America, and I would be curious as to what happens in developing countries as well. In the United States, we've really transformed our thinking to be aware that we have to start right at the very beginning, which is oftentimes before any symptoms have their onset. But now, actually, what we know about Alzheimer's disease is the same thing. Alzheimer's disease, if you wait until even mild cognitive dysfunction, you're really beyond the intervention time, and there are strategies in Alzheimer's disease already developed measures that we can implement that will help people with that. I shouldn't be answering the other questions.
What I would just add to one little thing to that is Dr. Trivedi and I did a talk the other day, and somebody said we were talking at very elevated terms, and somebody said, can you explain the difference between bipolar and depression? So let's back up just a second to talk a little bit about some things that I didn't even recognize in myself. And I have to say, in 2001, when I went into my primary care physician, he did not recognize as depression. So things I always look as depression is a giant shift from one's normal. Now, we all have different normals. But if you notice that someone is having a dramatic shift in their sleeping habits, either a lot more, a lot less, their eating habits, they're gaining a lot of weight, losing a lot of weight, their social interactions, their, again, extreme outwardness, partying, or extreme inwardness. So when you see a giant shift from that person's normal, you know, all of us who are mothers do this every day, right, with our children. So these are the kind of things I think to be aware of with people in your community. And I think we've reached a point in our community where we're so afraid to interfere in everybody else's affairs that we need to change that a little bit. I mean, we don't all need to become Gladys Kravitzes, which probably the young guys just ask somebody over 50 and they can tell you who Gladys Kravitz is. But we need to at least say, how are you doing, and actually listen to the answer. Because a lot of the suffering is going on. I would guarantee you out of this room, there's at least a quarter of people in this room that are being affected. If not, they're a family member or a close friend. So that's what I would add.
And on that, we'll end her words right there with people that suffer from depression, possibly bipolar. What do you have to do? You got to have a conversation with them. You got to talk to them. And when they move off of what is normal for them, then you should probably be interested in that. All right, we're going to take a break. I offer that as interesting stuff that Josh Goldberg showed me in a broader community-based way to deal with mental health issues. And this one in particular is depression. But, you know, extrapolate that, you know, across the spectrum, and you're going to see the same trends, right? Early detection, right? You're going to see that a very, very small percentage actually need to see a psychiatrist. But just about everybody can learn through about diet, sleep, exercise, all those affect your mental health, and talking about it. So, interesting stuff. So we'll take a break. Mike Bosselman set to join us next on Monday edition of All Marine Radio on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
Injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the ReadBoard page at allmarineradio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is if you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue, but it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
Hundreds of thousands of veterans have taken off their uniforms and put them away, carefully packed and safely stowed. But for some veterans, the uniform isn't so easily removed. The emotions experienced while serving continue to weigh on them. Life after service is different. Many veterans find transitioning difficult, and daily life is no longer as enjoyable as it once was. Some feel overwhelmed and lost. But that uncertainty doesn't take away from their strength and courage, nor does it take away from the sense of duty veterans carry with them. The transition from service is different for everyone. If you are a veteran going through a difficult time, or know one who is, the power of one person, one connection, one act of compassion can make a difference. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or visit veteranscrisisline.net.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.